1996 Sandstone Symposium presents discussion number 213, Wilkinson, the Man, by Gary James Pergera, with comments by Ford M. Anderson. Please note that because this is a 60-minute session, the last 30 minutes on the second side of this tape will be playing.
I show that it's about 8:46 or so, is that correct? Let's get started. This is session 213. Subject is Wilkinson, the Man. I'll introduce the two speakers, neither of whom I met until this morning, so I'm a wealth of information. My name is Gary Tyer.
What do we call the first speaker? Just the
first speaker, I suppose. Paper by Gary James Pergera. I like your first name a lot, Gary. Gary lives in Salt Lake City, Utah. He got his BS degree at Brigham Young University, Master of Public Administration from the Graduate School of Management, Brigham Young University, 1982. Gary is presently Director of Publishing, Vice President, Signature Books, Inc., Salt Lake City, Utah. He's also a Managing Editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. He's a Contract Editor of Utah County's Centennial History Project. He's been a Staff Editor of Sunstone. I'm not going to read all of this. He has, in the selected publications that were listed, there are 16 listed. Four of those articles were on Ernest L. Wilkinson. He also was the editor for Signature Books of the Autobiography of B.H. Roberts. So well qualified. Floyd M. Anderson, Dr. Anderson, received a Doctor of Education degree from Teachers College, Columbia University, and a dual major in psychology and family relations. He's taught full or part-time at five different universities. He's currently a psychologist and marriage and family therapist in private practice in Salt Lake City, Utah. He has written several articles in professional journals. Dr. Anderson was an Army Air Force pilot during World War II. Grew up primarily in Springville, Utah. He has been, I'm not sure, Executive Director of the American Institute of Family Relations, Hollywood, California, and President and Director of the California Family Guidance Center, Los Angeles, California. Didn't mention that Gary also grew up in Utah County in the Provo area. So, Gary, I'll turn the time over to you.
In the interest of time, let me just begin by saying that I probably won't be reading or alerting you to the fact where direct quotations appear. I'll probably just read it as part of the, you know, just the regular text without indicating a beginning quote mark and a closing quote mark. This paper begins with a very short epigraph by Ernest Wilkinson. "I know we at the BYU are operating the Lord's School, but I have to admit we are doing it with very human people, and I suppose that until the millennium, we will continue to have personal feuds." With his appointment in 1951 as seventh president of Mormon Church-owned Brigham Young University, Ernest L. Wilkinson inherited what one BYU dean called nothing more than a high-class junior college. 20 years later, the feisty Ogden, Utah native had transformed the lackluster school, in part by sheer force of his domineering will, into one of the largest private universities in the United States. An inveterate overachiever, Wilkinson had spent his first 50 years trying to rise above the poverty and shame of the seedy two-bit streets he had grown up in. Now at the pinnacle of an impressive hard-won career as a lawyer that had earned him both respect and wealth, he desperately wanted his alma mater to appear well on paper. Wilkinson had the ability to set extremely demanding objectives, colleague William F. Edwards remembered, and to pay whatever price was required to achieve them. Ernest certainly knew what he was working for and knew how to work toward it and get it, added another early BYU appointee, Virginia Cutler. And he knew pretty well how to work with the general authorities. Oh, it's political. It really is. True, Wilkinson did not labor alone. He was supported by a wife who subsumed her own dreams to those of her ambitious husband and raised their five children in what was essentially a single-parent home. He also gathered around him a tightly knit core of loyal, hand-picked lieutenants who shared his single-minded commitment to BYU's future, even if they sometimes privately disagreed with his methods. Ernest and I didn't have the same philosophy of life, nor did we have the same philosophy of education, recalled BYU Vice President Harvey Taylor, who later became acting LDS Commissioner of Education. But I made up my mind when I came that I was going to be loyal to him and support him, regardless of our differences. If I couldn't, I'd leave. Finally, Wilkinson enjoyed the virtually unqualified support of church president and prophet, David O. McKay, as well as the backing of a board of trustees who jointly served as high-ranking church leaders. But more than any other single factor, it was a combination of Wilkinson's unrelenting drive, intimidating personality, and autocratic managerial style that both defined and propelled his vision of BYU as the University of the Kingdom of God on Earth. After 25 years as a prosperous Washington, D.C. attorney and congressional strategist, Wilkinson returned to Provo, Utah in early 1951, fully aware of the larger-than-life, no-nonsense persona he had cultivated and encouraged as much as was victimized by. "I never aspired to be a popular president," he admitted. I did aspire to get things done, and the two were not always compatible. BYU's official history, which Wilkinson oversaw and helped edit following his resignation in 1971, acknowledged that the erstwhile educator could be abrupt, inflexible, gruff, inconsiderate, even coldly uninterested. Subordinates with sensitive feelings or temperamental personalities, it continued disingenuously, sometimes found it frustrating to endure the pressure of working with him. "There is no time to discuss matters when a contact is made with you," Dinesha Woodruff complained shortly after Wilkinson's inauguration. "We get the impression that many of our problems are not important enough to receive much time, or that you have already made up your mind about some matters before we feel they have been fully aired." 2 decades later, top-ranking church leader and occasional adversary Harold B. Lee publicly characterized the equally pugnacious Wilkinson as tempestuous, strong-willed, and powerful in speech. "When I get to my feet and speak extemporaneously," Wilkinson joked, "only the good Lord can restrain me, and he generally doesn't." "I suppose that I have someday got to learn the lesson of keeping my own trap shut," he conceded, "since I am criticizing others for opening theirs. Don't you know," he would say, "I don't have time to be polite." "President Wilkinson didn't understand the word no very much," commented the school's public communications director. "Convinced that we grow more by criticism than we do by praise, Wilkinson once complimented one of his vice presidents, because he lets me know what is going on and is candid and frank with me in his opinions. Others of my associates fail to let me know what is going on and often do not talk frankly to me." Yet while he stressed that he did not want yes men, Wilkinson insisted that ultimate policies will be my responsibility and your decisions must in turn be reviewed by me. Wilkinson knew he could be too blunt, not tactful with people, and impatient with other people who did not produce as much. He valued the political appearance of consensus and harmony, explaining that it's unwise to publicize the criticisms of one's enemies. Once, fearing the reproach he knew his aggressive temperament could elicit, he ordered that all campus news stories be severely scrutinized with the objective of avoiding the possibility of the following charges being leveled against him, Wilkinson personally, and BYU as well. 1, extravagance, 2, boasting, 3, ambition. "I think you and I are both completely cognizant of the criticism that he faces," his aide gingerly wrote to the school's public relations director, "if stories are released with an undue emphasis on any of the above-mentioned points." Wilkinson later directed all who prepare letters for the president's signature that, 1, letters for the general authorities are to be signed faithfully yours, letters to friends of mine should be signed cordially, letters to alumni and friends of the institution should be signed sincerely. "I do not use the phrase yours very truly," he closed. "It is a commercial phrase and not appropriate for my letters." Few associates found the 5-foot-5-inch tall president likable, describing him as paternalistic, dictatorial, inconsiderate. "Lots of people go away shaking their heads at that man," remembered BYU's public relations director. "It's just that he makes them so angry, and it goes back to that lawyer's training. he theorized. A lot of people didn't like him at all, agreed Family Living Dean Virginia Cutler, because he was so certain of what he wanted. For them, he was the little general, little Caesar, little Napoleon, Tasmanian devil, or that evil genius. Yet for others, he could be energetic, committed, even sympathetic, an academic Georgie Patton, unafraid to tell it like it is. Wilkinson was easy to caricature, academic Vice President Robert K. Thomas observed. He could be rough, crude, hard to get along with, and a fighter determined to have his own way. I can't see why people get angry, Wilkinson wondered. In law, we fight with each other, but we go to lunch right after because that's part of our game. I find now that oftentimes I talk to people and I find them getting angry because we differ. When two combative people get together, he added, the air gets warm. Fine Arts Dean Garrett DeYoung remembered. Wilkinson was raised under the motto, if you are right, plead the law. If you are wrong, shout like hell and get your way anyhow. He had the tenacity of the proverbial English bulldog, another faculty member recalled. I guess that's one of the qualities that enabled him to do what he did, both as a university president and within his life. I don't know of anyone whom I have enjoyed working for more than Ernest Wilkinson, reported BYU physical plant director Sam Brewster. You always know where you stand with him. You know what he wants. He doesn't hesitate to tell you. It is easier to put brakes on him, J. Reuben Clark, counselor to David O. McKay, commented, than it would be to get someone who needs some dynamite all of the time. While his wife, Alice, frankly wondered if her husband's impatient temperament could fit into a group of academicians, Wilkinson freely granted that she had made the friends, he the enemies. A quintessential man of action, Wilkinson did not consider himself contemplative, was uncomfortable simply sitting and listening, and seldom read the scriptures or any other book. He lived to work, espousing what he termed a pragmatic spirituality, and routinely spent weekends, including Sundays, in his office. I hope the good Lord or his priesthood bearers who judge me, he wrote, will take into consideration that while I have often violated the fourth commandment to rest on the Sabbath, I did try to attend my meetings, and the work I did the remainder of the day was never in pursuit of pleasure, but was to build and strengthen his university. Nor did he have much time or desire for literature, art, drama, or music. His campus office in the Mazur Building and later Smoot Building, which custodial staff christened the Hornet's Nest, was a scene of organized confusion. BYU student newspaper reported in 1958. On one table are three stacks of desk trays, numbering 17 in all. The walls lined with portraits of Mormon leaders, past BYU presidents, and U.S. Supreme Court justices. His life's goals, the report continued, to eat three good meals a day, have health to work until the end, and to die in the harness. He also reserved for his own use every day at noon a fully equipped weight room in the field house. Custodians who would usher him in and then lock the door behind so that no one could disturb him referred to this as the therapy room. Ever the lawyer, conscious of the need for a good defense, Wilkinson prided himself on always keeping a record of understandings made so that there would be no questions about me keeping my word. In fact, his memo writing became legendary. Writing memos is his hobby, his public relations director teased. He lived to write them, agreed the editor of BYU's student body newspaper, and you could not out-memo him. He'd always answer a memo with a comment, and if you thank him for the comment, he'd write you another memo saying he received yours and on into the second coming. During the last 2 days, complained academic vice president Earl C. Crockett in 1966, I have received such a flood of memorandums from you, requesting additional kinds of statistical information, different ways of doing things, questions to answers, etc., that I feel overwhelmed. More humorously, one custodian remembered being asked by Wilkinson to dispose of some of the carbon copies of memos, which the custodian called telegrams. We did not have paper shredders, the custodian recalled. However, we did have an incinerator. We took the telegrams to the incinerator, confident that we could burn them without incident. However, the paper on which the telegrams were written was light, and the draft from the fires was so great that it took the telegrams up the chimney and deposited them all over campus. The outside fringe of the paper was all that was burned, so the telegram could be easily read. An irate Wilkinson summoned nearly the entire physical plant staff to collect the confidential debris. It was quite a sight, the custodian continued, men crawling around on hands and knees on tops of roofs, roadways, and lawns, collecting the elusive telegrams. They eventually ended up in the city dump, buried beneath the rubble. I am not unaware of the fact that at times I seem to be unreasonable and unyielding, Wilkinson confessed to one of his long-suffering secretaries. While many people think that I have boundless energy, the fact is that I often get very tired, but I have learned that mind is superior to matter, and that if I will just put my mind to it, I can generally overcome my physical fatigue. If I sometimes offend people, it is not because I want to, but because I am determined to get something done. "I continuously rebel at having to take the time to see people who come to see me," he confided to his diary. "I finally grudgingly consent to see them, knowing in the first place that I should happily see them. This is, however, because of the many pressures on me. I have to admit that I do not always have the energy I once had, and at times I get so exasperated and tired that I am hardly fit to work with." Sometimes Wilkinson counseled in a particularly self-revealing address on strong administrative leadership, "It is better to make a wrong decision than to make no decision at all." Sometimes he acts in haste and repents in leisure, BYU's public relations director clarified. For Wilkinson, a strong leader must, one, face the realities and problems of life and take responsibility for solving them, two, listen, study, evaluate, and make decisions, three, have faith in himself, four, demean himself so that others may have confidence in him, and five, is dedicated to his cause and has faith in his maker. In making decisions, he explained, in words that just as easily described himself, "The administrator may often have to reject the advice of his closest advisors. And because of the close personal relationship, this is one of the most difficult tasks that I find for an administrator. In one sense, it requires more courage than a physical encounter. But somehow, lieutenants must be taught to learn that the decision must be that of the leader. Then the administrator must see that his decision is enforced and respected by all those who are governed by it." In fact, he never made a decision, Wilkinson guessed, that wasn't objected to by someone. Of his sometimes perplexed, sometimes perplexing faculty, Wilkinson feared that the lives of too many have been cloistered on the campus and do not have a practical touch. Faculty eggheads can be a little too theoretical, he opined, knowing, as Vice President Robert Thomas sensed, that he would never be completely comfortable in the academic mold. "I probably have much more strength in rewriting legal briefs than I do in my personal work at the university," Wilkinson admitted. "It is easier on me, and I do it with more effectiveness. Students, however, were a different matter. It is easier to speak the plain truth to students than to a sophisticated faculty," he commented. "We corrode with the years." In fact, he lamented, "I have found that it's much easier to handle the students than it is to handle a sophisticated faculty. The latter know too much, or think they do." He bristled at having to refer to faculty as Dr. or Mr., urging instead the affectionate salutation of brother, which would be far preferable and would be a better example for the students. His periodic comparisons of lawyers and educators invariably resulted in his offending the latter. "In the interest of upgrading the performance of our teaching profession as a whole," he once lectured, "we would do well to accept more of the process of review, evaluation, appraisal, competition, and measures of achievement that are inherent in other professions, together with the very real stimulus of relating our monetary reward to our effort and performance, rather than to the stultifying criteria of degrees and tenures to which our public school salary schedules are now almost entirely wedded." For those BYU faculty who believed that the contribution any university makes to society depends mostly on the freedom of action given the faculty in academic matters, Wilkinson's approach to governance was unapologetically hands-on and unilateral. "The administration is always happy to have the suggestions of students, faculty members, and the universe respecting matters for the advancement and purposes of the university," he announced within weeks of his installation as president. "But it must be understood that in the final analysis, the determination of what shall be the policy of the university with respect to any matter rests with the Board of Trustees, composed of the First Presidency, the Quorum of the Twelve, and the Church Commissioner of Education. In the administration of university affairs, the president may, in his discretion, submit certain matters to the Dean's Council, or the faculty, or the student body, or any other committees, but the decisions of these groups, or any of them, are only advisory to the president or Board of Trustees, either of whom may accept or reject them in his or its sound discretion. Wilkinson repeatedly insisted that all correspondence with trustees and other church leaders be routed through his office so as to prevent the church authorities from being bothered with minor details which should be taken care of by the administration, and so that the administration will be aware of criticisms and both sides can be presented. He also believed that much of the information that had to be taken into consideration in making decisions was confidential and should not be disclosed to faculty. "Any person on the faculty having a gripe," he stressed, "ought to be man enough to come to the administrative officers and make that gripe direct, rather than by anonymity under the cloak of some irresponsible committee." Not surprisingly, most faculty recognized that their voice in university policymaking was limited. Wilkinson eventually came to believe that a lack of enthusiasm among graduating students was due in part to criticism of the administration, which they hear from their teachers. "My first two or three years were the most fruitful," he wrote nostalgically after 7 years. "My complete lack of understanding that most matters should go through faculty committees was a godsend to me. Otherwise, many of the reforms that we have accomplished would not have been achieved. I am afraid I have now become too cautious. I have today resolved to again be more forthright in what I am doing." He found most faculty committees to be a waste of time, and groused, "In any other place than an educational institution, questions would be decided by one or two parties quickly, and I rather think with just as good a result. Faculties are notoriously unresponsive in meetings, the opposite of students," he added. "With students, their emotions are pretty much on the surface. Faculty members bury theirs and then seal them in." Only after 2 decades of sometimes rancorous give and take, coupled with encouragement from outside accreditation agencies, did Wilkinson begrudgingly allow formation of a strictly advisory faculty council in 1970. This insistence that he be completely in control of the school, BYU's official history concluded, became one of the characteristics of Wilkinson's administration. Wilkinson believed that his first priority on campus was to convert a lackadaisical board of trustees to his expansive vision of BYU, even to the exclusion of a good working relationship with his faculty, and spent lots of time preparing for trustees meetings. His strategy was relatively, perhaps deceptively, simple. 1, present his proposals for change to the board. 2, secure the board's endorsement. And 3, implement the board's decisions as official BYU policy. "New brooms sweep cleaner than old," he remarked to an early confidant. "And I know that while I'm new, I have a better chance with the board." He appreciated that relations with the board is a very delicate matter, and one stumble may be more devastating than many trips up the stairs. More particularly, he worried that he always seemed to run into difficulty whenever he went to board meetings feeling a little overconfident. Proposals he failed to secure approval of, he routinely blamed on his miserable presentation. Still, whatever his shortcomings, Wilkinson could be impressive, using his rhetorical skills and legal training and experience to their fullest. When Wilkinson appeared before the board, David L. McKay once teased, "He could make black look white. He would come in and say he would take just a few minutes on a matter, and then he would take half an hour." "When he comes into our meeting," J. Reuben Clark agreed, "he is so well prepared that he presents matters as though he were presenting them to the Supreme Court, and we don't have any answer for his arguments. Ernest comes in here with the most elaborate set of hogwash that I've ever seen," Harold Bealey reportedly concurred, "and he always gets what he wants, because there is no point at which you can attack it. There is no point where you can show that it is wrong. There is no point where you can show a fallacy in his argument." Furthermore, Wilkinson nurtured a special arrangement with David O. McKay, which he termed priming, or lobbying, giving him privileged access to the venerable church leader, a relationship McKay cherished as well. As president of the church and chair of the Board of Trustees, McKay could overrule with his one vote an otherwise unanimous board decision. "I recognize that at times you may have thought I was pressing certain matters a little vigorously, or probably proceeding a little too fast," Wilkinson wrote to McKay after 3 years. "But I have done this on the theory that you would much prefer to tighten the reins than apply the whip. If Wilkinson wanted something and was turned down by the board," explained BYU's treasurer, "he'd go around the board and go straight to David L. McKay. Brother McKay was easy pickings for Wilkinson. He could get an audience with President McKay when he needed to," reported Joseph Bentley, Wilkinson's special financial assistant. "Sometimes when the board wouldn't give him something that he thought the school needed, he'd go to President McKay and get it on a shortcut, which wasn't good procedure, I suppose, and it didn't make the board happy." Indeed, for many church functionaries, Wilkinson's end runs threatened their own lines of authority as well as established church protocol. "One of the most constant frustrations I have at the church office building, and I am not alone in this," Wilkinson complained to his diary in 1960, "is that I'm trying to get to see President McKay through his secretary. I found that she was in her office, but she told me that my wife had called and that I was to call back to Provo immediately, and that I could do so at another telephone outside. By the time I got this telephone through, she had locked the door on me. There was no question that it was purposeful. I waited until 8:15 a.m. and then knocked hard on her door. She told me that she would let me know when President McKay came in. Nonetheless, I watched for him, and when he went to go through the door, I was behind him." In others, Wilkinson recognized this tendency as human nature, which I have met before. "Where self-interest is at stake," he observed, "human nature will still assert itself." As for his own direct appeals to McKay, however, Wilkinson emphasized that he was acting in the best interests of BYU and not out of his own ambition. This strategy of ex parte intervention became another hallmark of Wilkinson's administrative style. Predictably, when McKay's health started to fail in the 1960s, Wilkinson's base of support began to erode. "The president is slowly deteriorating in health," he wrote in 1965, "and unfortunately he does not remember anything after conferences had with him unless he has a written memorandum on it. Everything I take up with him must be in writing or he will not execute it." This is a sad development. With McKay in decline, his counselors and others stepped forward to take up the slack, but not without cross signals and mixed messages. "It generally happens that when the leadership is not able to crack the whip," Wilkinson recorded several months later, "his lieutenants start feuding, and this unfortunately is true at the present time. Where there is no one person in active charge," he added in 1967, "there is a tendency for the brethren to go off in opposite directions, with the result that faculty members confer with general authorities whose views they think they share. This is most unfortunate and lends itself to great difficulty in the administration of the BYU." 2 years later, the situation had worsened. "Problems are multiplying," Wilkinson confided. "We will have to face them some way or another. The difficulty is that President McKay does not have the physical energy to give directions, and others are going off in many directions. It's a time of lack of top leadership in the church, which causes no end of problems. The balance of the day I spent on miscellaneous matters having to do with the complete turmoil in Salt Lake City occasioned by President McKay's illness, and therefore lack of leadership," he wrote the following September. "Everyone seems to be trying to fill in with all kinds of cross currents going." The predicament would only resolve itself 4 months later in January 1970 with McKay's death. Given his disdain of group decision making, Wilkinson realized early in his administration that working with a board of trustees, whom he described as 15 bosses, could be just as frustrating as managing a diverse faculty. At the same time, he knew that despite McKay's support, such intra-group politicking was unavoidable. "I have little patience for singling out the members of my executive committee and spending a long period of time to try to convert them to a point of view, but I am nevertheless certain that conferences of this kind will be beneficial to me, even if I do not accomplish my specific ends." He also discovered that trustees were sometimes more concerned with moral and religious questions than with the technical problems of education, including the academic preparation of faculty members, and that many held conflicting viewpoints about the future of BYU. After 4 years, he concluded that since matters of administration involve questions of judgment and not principles of theological interpretation, "I would thereafter take fewer things to the Board of Trustees, use my best judgment in making my decisions myself, many decisions myself, knowing that in any event, members of the Board of Trustees would not all make the same decision, and knowing further, based on my own experience, that unless I make some serious mistake, the entire board would generally support me in my decision. I have found that great deference is paid by the Board of Trustees to the administrator, and he is generally supported, even though individual members of the Board of Trustees may have decided otherwise in the first instance." Once, in response to the criticism of one trustee, Wilkinson recorded, "I am sure that the entire board does not feel this way, so we are ignoring this protest." On another occasion, he complained directly to President McKay about a recent board decision. "I told him I thought we had probably failed in using proper judgment and imagination in our leadership. I further told him I was not ready to recommend a reversal of our recommendation, but I wondered if he had any objection to me personally re-examining the entire question. He was enthusiastic about this suggestion and told me to proceed." At other times, he expressed disappointment that trustees didn't penetrate deeper into his recommendations so as to have the benefit of a sharp exchange of views, which is always helpful, or feared that the questions trustees asked revealed that the board really was not aware of what was going on. "One of the problems in a theocracy," he acknowledged shortly before his resignation, "is that the brethren are sometimes unwilling to speak their minds on different matters that are raised. I think they ought to speak their minds at the time, and if the first presidency want to overrule them, they can do so." While most board meetings were orderly, congenial, and harmonious, others were marked by special interests, divided loyalties, personality clashes, and outright feuds. Even among the general authorities, Wilkinson observed, "When it comes to administrative matters, there can be sharp differences of opinion. Try as best the brethren do to resolve their differences," he explained. There still are individual differences in judgment, and I suppose there always will be. But I have a strong testimony as to the divinity of their respective callings. "I have been disappointed in one aspect over my present job," he subsequently admitted to senior churchman J. Reuben Clark. that I sometimes, in accordance with decisions, would cross certain bridges and then have the bridges torn out by the brethren through changing their minds, and that I had been left stranded. I told him that I expected such things in politics, but didn't expect in church administration. But I didn't expect them in church administration. He said he knew that certain change of decisions had been made that couldn't be justified after I had gone ahead, and even though I stayed, I should expect more of the same kind of mistakes. He said that Elder John A. Woodso used to comment often that he was sorry the Lord had such imperfect hands to execute the decisions of his church. In 1961, after a particularly off-putting experience with one church official, he resolved, "I am going to beg off from any other assignments given to me by the First Presidency, because in exchange for an awful lot of work, all I got was ingratitude. At times, even President McKay's intervention could not be relied on. The peace-loving soul that he is," Wilkinson admitted, "it is very difficult for him to make decisions regardless of their merits, where there is violent opposition." In fact, Wilkinson thought that McKay had difficulty making categorical decisions, was not a strong executive, never successfully disciplined his associates to keep them in line, and felt that one of McKay's counselors, Stephen L. Richards, had actually been responsible for many of McKay's decisions during the 1950s. "I would 100 times prefer to argue a case before the Supreme Court than I would this matter," a PhD in engineering, "before the Board of Trustees," he said in early 1968, "because in the Supreme Court, I knew I would be given a full hearing, and here I knew that some members of the board were against it. Even the brethren can be better inspired," he noted after 10 years, "if they know what the facts are when they decide a question, and I don't believe that the good Lord intended that they would always be inspired when they made decisions without the facts when those facts are available. Even when one is dealing with the brethren, whom we look upon as being inspired, and I think that on the whole they are," he added, before the end of the year, "yet one has to be very persistent in order to attain his ends. I am reminded of what Brother J. Golden Kimball said," he sometimes consoled himself, "namely, that he was sure the gospel was true, or otherwise the missionaries would have ruined it a long time ago. May I add that if the gospel were not true, the human characteristics of some of the general authorities would have ruined it a long time ago. We must make distinction, however, between the gospel and certain procedures in the church. The revealed word of God is sacrosanct. The procedures and day-to-day administrative decisions to carry out the gospel are not, especially when lieutenants of the president try to impose their will on decisions which he should make." Still, the going could be rough. "I have had some serious disputes as to the methods and operation and growth of the church school system," he noted in 1965. "As to these, I have sometimes been overruled, but decided to go along with the brethren, and unless I can do that, I had better resign." 4 years later, he added, "There have been many times when I have appeared before the Executive Committee of the Board of Trustees when, because of the cantankerous nature of some of the members, I wondered whether my efforts were worth pursuing. The general authorities, like everyone else," he wrote after his resignation, "are human, and when their own ox is gored, they want special consideration." Near the end of his 20-year tenure, the strain of his sometimes turbulent relationship with the board, especially with Harold B. Lee, was taking an increasing toll. "The brethren really are not interested in what is going on at the Brigham Young University except for decisions which they have to make," he wrote during a particularly pessimistic moment. "So from now on, they will get a famine of information. I will confine it to the decisions which they make, some of which they will make without the basic information which they must have." The next year, as he addressed the board for the first time about his departure, he was more mellow. "I told them," he recorded, "that this church belonged to me as much as it did to them, and that therefore I felt I had a right to express my opinion." 4 years later, now retired, he had grown philosophical, even resigned. "One of the peculiarities of Mormonism," he reflected less than 3 years before his death in April 1978, perhaps thinking as much about himself as anyone, "is that administrators can get together and gripe as to the decisions of the board, but in the end, they are deeply loyal to those decisions." Throughout his adult life, if not before, what Ernest Wilkinson wanted most from family and friends was their respect. Respect for the poor street rowdy who had made good despite almost insurmountable odds. Only in his 70s, as he faced the prospects of forced retirement, did he seem to have also wanted their love and affection. After struggling tooth and nail for more than 60 years to earn the respect he craved, he found the rewards of his achievement more bittersweet than expected. For with the admiration and deference he effortlessly elicited came fear, distrust, and antipathy. As his own children watched their father dote on and occasionally play with their children and grandchildren, they could not help but feel a sense of loss for the father they had never known. Yet it is unlikely that Wilkinson ever regretted much the price he paid for his dreams of greatness. He was not given to regrets or second-guessing. He knew what his strengths and weaknesses were, whether he understood them fully or not. He knew what he was, what he stood for, what he believed in, and what others thought of him. And he knew how he would be remembered. Thanks.
As you know, in any presentation, in trying to discuss the personality of another individual, like when I see a patient of mine, there's always a sense of tentativeness, an uncertainty, and a potential for distortion by virtue of the fact that this is not the person who's really the one who is describing through his own feelings what has happened. And so, in turn, I think that while you have a lot of information through Dr. Wilkinson's diaries and things, we also have to realize that there are ramifications of this that are up to our own kinds of speculation. I feel this particularly in terms of my own experience, because while I served 5 years under Dr. Wilkinson on the faculty at the BYU, and then later became his son-in-law, at which time he didn't remember me at all, of course. It was still a perspective that limited many of the things that I perceived. At the same time, I think that if there is ever a presentation that takes in the entire scope of the kinds of characteristics and draws from an extremely diverse source of information to present a picture of ELW, Ernest L. Wilkinson, certainly Gary has done it, an incredible job. And I think the very fact that he has entitled the focus of today's subject as being Wilkinson the man says that he wants to look at him as a whole person. And I think that's a very admirable and a very desirable kind of thing, because it's so easy to become focused totally upon simply certain characteristics that either bother us or impress us. And to try and see a person as in the totality of what they are as a human being is an extremely desirable way of approaching human personality. One of the things that I think he points out in the process is a number of extremely antithetical dimensions to the personality of Ernest Wilkinson that put him into the category of being both controversial and certainly seeming contradictory. Yet at the same time, when you understand the wholeness of the man, you recognize that it is not contradictory, that it is indeed integrous with the type of personality that he developed. The paper is not just about his abrasive personality and dictatorial managerial style, but reveals some of the needs and fears that drove him. It discusses not only his meticulous preparation and tenacity in pursuing his goals, but his emotional reactions in the face of the opposition and hostility of those who disagreed with him and sought to thwart and negate his commitments and efforts. It recognizes not only his judgmentalism and efforts to control by edict and to impose his convictions on others, but it even sometimes devious means, but it also refers to the values and beliefs that he held, that he carried into his own life. And it also refers to the satisfaction in making contact with the new students, his way of relating, crushing though it was. If any of you have the occasion to shake hands with him, you know what I'm talking about. And in turn, he demonstrated his caring for people in very overt ways of not only being extremely generous, but it's also being very paternalistic and helpful and trying and sometimes to take over when he wasn't really wanted. It allows us to see him as a very bright and capable man, but not as an intellectual per se. or even knowledgeable, as he acknowledges, in many areas such as art, drama, or music. And he was indeed intimidated by those who had better knowledge and better educations and better concepts of certain kind of aspects of philosophy and so on. I was particularly struck when Alice and I developed our relationship some 22 years ago, and in the process of being finally brought to the point of meeting him as a prospective son-in-law, he summarily dismissed the two Alices, Alice's mother and my wife, and proceeded to interrogate me, even though I was 50 years old at the time. He also pursued, I was teaching at the time at Cal State, as well as I had a clinic called the California Family Guidance Center in LA, and he sent out his spies to inquire about my background, and I came to school one day, and the dean of my college says, you know, somebody's been inquiring about you. And he was thorough. He was concerned. He was loving in that way, you see. In turn, as he also permitted to become aware of his capacity to recognize and acknowledge his own lack of tact. He acknowledged that he offended people and created enemies with his manners and attitudes, but professed a lack of intent, which I think is true, and rationalized his responsibility by attributing it to his determination to get things done, and sometimes to fatigue. And these are true. But it reflects an awareness that a lot of times people were totally oblivious to. ELW lacked the capacity to relate to others in a warm, relaxed, comfortable way. He was uncomfortable in unstructured social situations, even with his family, where he would talk business or politics. Felt able to do. When I first met him in California after my relationship with Alice, and we started to visit, as I told you, he immediately got into the business. He wanted to deal with what was happening. He didn't want to sit and chat and so on. He could not be either emotionally or physically intimate in talking about or showing his feelings to others, or in physically being demonstrative with his wife or children. Yet, indirectly, he reflects an awareness of some of his own feelings, his hurts, and his resentments in his diaries. But his denial is demonstrated in his comments about overcoming fatigue. He could overcome his fatigue through his mental determination. He did that so well. But one family member said he didn't have any feelings, was his initial comment. The children remember some occasions of camaraderie, but not real companionship, of talking, or joking, or laughing, or touching, or expressions of warmth. It was stilted, awkward, and uncomfortable, an unfamiliar way of being. At the same time, however, he demonstrated his caring by what he did. When Alice's first husband, John Mangum, was killed, he immediately took over being the parent. That's where he came down to look me up when I got involved. He took over in terms of trying to make sure she was economically secure, in terms of trying to help out in every way that he possibly could. This was his way of showing love, and a very legitimate way of showing love, a very significant aspect of love, but it is not intimacy. In turn, one of the things that we need to ask, therefore, is what was behind this? Well, if you look at his background, which he refers to in his books, Earnestly Yours and others, he then tells of having grown up in Ogden, the north side and what, close to what's called Hell's Half Acre. But he also tells of the experiences that he had there, but he grew up in a family of eight children. His father, no, he wasn't in eight children, his was six. The oldest one died at about three or four, so E.L. was the oldest one. But his father had come across from Scotland with his father when he was only 10, had only a third grade education, moved from job to job. A comment that was made is every time the rent came due, we moved. So that the itinerant nature of the family, the continual anxiety that they lived with, the father worked two jobs many times and was obviously a hard worker. At 82, he went down and worked his way on a steamer around the Horn or down through the Panama Canal and showed up in New York to see the family when nobody expected him. But at the same time, he had many jobs and moved from one job to the other. The wife was the one who was the strength of the family. She was also, in quotes, the smartest. And as a result, she was the one who was determined to give some stability to the family and tried to do so not simply by, in a sense, not going along with her husband's desire for a farm, because she considered him a very inept manager, and he was, but she also emphasized the importance of her children getting an education, and she took all the money she could to give them the education. At the same time, however, while she emphasized that and took the money he wanted to put into a farm, into the education, it resulted in what is almost an ongoing battle. There was conflict almost every day. And as a result, it impacted all of the children. And when you see a dysfunctional family, you almost inevitably see diverse ways in which the children try to deal with that. Some of them escape into fantasies or into indolence. Some of them move toward trying to prove themselves in a variety of ways. Others become, you know, we all develop ways of trying to cope with our own pain. And as a result, you see this in the Wilkinson family. And certainly Ernest was the one who moved in a very positive direction. But why? Well, in some ways, he points out the fact that when the parents fought, or he didn't point it out, but the idea was that as the parents fought, and he experienced the absenteeism of his father a great deal, and the continual negation almost of the father, he ended up, as he got a little bit older, at a very young age, having to be the one who took over. But before he took over, he went through his own pain, and that was, he got involved a lot with some of the hoods of the neighborhood. One of the men that he bought, there was a lot of cockfighting, which was against the law. There was a lot of gambling and drinking and smoking and things among the crowd that he ran with. But as he did that, he became involved with this. He had a paper route for the Deseret News, and as he went out on the paper route, he used the money for these particular activities until he was around 12, 13, 14, 15. And at that time, one of the guys that he had bought one of the cocks with to be in the cockfight was killed outside of his home because he had been involved in a effort to get money from one of the local famous Utah wealthy men. And that death shook Ernest. He then began to try and move away from the crowd. And as he tried to move away from this crowd, he had a bunch of buddies that they would meet and smoke and do other things together. It was really difficult because here was a very timid and in some ways a very lonely man, little boy, who was trying to extricate himself from what warmth he had, because the mother was very capable. She'd sit them down on the linoleum and tell them what for, but she was not an affectionate woman. And there was a great dearth of intimacy and warmth within the family. In growing up, therefore, he had to learn to fend for himself. He says in the book, because my father lacked a business judgment and the great difficulty which my mother had in making her up her mind, it fell to my lot in my early teens to make many decisions for the family. This was very difficult for me because, like my father, I had developed an inferiority complex. and was frightened to death of business transactions. Later, of course, he berated those who couldn't face the fears that they had and confront issues when he was in the administration. And he learned to block out his feelings and overcome, just as he did, overcome his physical fears. I recall one time being sent to the bank by my mother to borrow money, a relatively small amount. I think I walked back and forth past the door of that bank 10 times before I finally dared to go in. Contrary to what most people think, this timidity has continued with me, and even now, and he was talking to the student body at the BYU, I have to summon all my courage to meet people whom I greatly respect or to transact certain kinds of business. And so you see, basically here, out of this environment, he finally was faced with the situation where he moved toward doing what his mother wanted, and that is that when he became about 15 and he experienced the death and the withdrawal and the pain of this, he had a tremendous struggle moving away from his buddies. And then he turned to academics, because he then began to go to BYU Academy upon the insistence of his mother, and it was like he then shut out this world over here and he moved toward the productive, aggressive. He took over the parental role within the family, which he continued to maintain. And he said, I remember the first time I debated in high school, I shook for days. So that fear was a profoundly deep and pervasive one that he had to learn to cope with. And the way you learn to cope with it is blocking it out, a lot of denial, which sets the stage then for this person who's able to move ahead and do what he had to do, to be driven, as it were, to try and accomplish in order to overcome the feelings of insecurity that you have, the fears that you have. But you get this drive in order, as it were, to make up for and to block out these underlying feelings that he had of inferiority and inadequacy that we all have. What does it do to you inside in a home of constant conflict? He came out of it with the incredible drive. He learned to block out the conflict. He learned, as it were, to try and cope. A very constructive, very positive, very productive way in one dimension of his life. But in the other, it of course required such kinds of denial that he functioned in ways that were alienating and depriving. He represents a classic example of many of the world's great leaders, past and present, the famous and the infamous, the truly accomplished and incredibly productive people of this world, who have had the intellectual capacity and the unique cognitive ability, along with, and perhaps the most important of all, the underlying intensity of emotional needs and fears that create in them an excessive drive, an obsessive commitment to accomplish as a means of escaping from and compensating for their deep self-doubt, inner conflict, and often unrecognized feelings of a lack of worth that they had somehow experienced in growing up. Feelings that preclude their experiencing truly fulfilling human relations, emotional intimacy on a personal level, and that lock them into a world and a way of being that, while serving as a protection against their fear of hurt, left them truly alone amidst the multitudes they knew and with a profound underlying sense of loneliness. And I think this was true of Ernest L. Wilkinson. He was a fine man, an exceptional man, certainly a productive man, and in his way a loving man. But he was restricted in the development of his emotional self, resulting in his excessive cognitive and functional orientation, and living his life with intense drive for the satisfaction of achievement, but without the emotional aliveness of experiencing the intimacy and the fulfillment of being a free and loving human being. It's like a person who is anemic, and when they lack the blood, the red corpuscles in their blood, and they are tired all the time, they turn to what they know in order to give them energy, and that is carbohydrates. And they become increasingly anemic, and the struggle goes on. He was restricted in the development. The result of each child, to the pain and confusion is to try and do whatever they know how or whatever they feel capable of doing. He chose well. He produced well. He accomplished well. He had contributed incredibly to the world, and for that he deserves tremendous recognition, not just blame. Thank you.
Ernest L. Wilkinson's daughter and the wife of Dr. Anderson asked if she could speak for about 3 minutes, which I have agreed to.
I did ask for permission to do this. I thought that maybe this might bring about some sort of concluding feeling about my father. You know, when you live with a psychologist, you really have to listen very selectively and very intently, and with an open but somewhat jaded eye. Otherwise, you can find cause and effect and reason for everything you do. But you know what? It makes for marvelous bedtime conversation. And Floyd and I have enjoyed many bedtime conversations discussing my father. Floyd, you did a good job. I think that in my own declining years, I have discovered that what used to wrinkle me and used to raise my hackles really only makes me smile now. It's a kind of a covert amusement, I think, when I listen to the controversy that surrounds my father, even 20 years after his death. I do think that this is the price that accomplished men pay. People love to dissect them, they love to fractionalize them, and they love to impose their own projections, and I am just one of those as well. But I do think that I have to laugh at many of the things that people say or the names that people call my father. And I'm quickly going to just go through a litany very briefly of names, and they all fit him. They are all forms of endearment, and I think they describe in essence a Wilkinson the man. BYU, of course, called him president. The students called him Old Iron Man. David O. McKay called him principled. The Newcomb Society called him a builder. The Democrats called him an opportunist. Norman Vincent Peale called him a dynamic Christian. Time Magazine called him an eccentric Mormon. The American Coalition of Patriotic Societies called him a fearless champion. Utah Holiday called him a Tasmanian devil. Jeffrey Holland called him a visionary. The Daily Universe called him the Palm Springs paradox. He called himself blunt, tactless, impatient, to which the nurses at LDS Hospital cried, amen. He was a terrible patient. The Indians called him Chief Frantic Bear. My friends called him Big Daddy Bear. He was likened, as Gary pointed out, to Horatio Alger, Napoleon, Caesar, take your pick. But I, of course, have called him Daddy. And I find that there is absolutely nothing wrong with being relentless and contentious and resolute when good things happen. Which brings us to Gary's paper. If the diary of ELW has any validity at all in his personal observations about himself, then this paper deals as much with human nature in general as it does himself. Imperfect men in situations of power always make for struggle. All men like to be stroked, they like to be recognized, and they like to be encouraged. And certainly his vision for BYU always put him in a power struggle with the brethren. But I want to make this one point, and I prefer to believe that his diaries were really for his own therapeutic sanity rather than for public dissection. But public they had become simply because he allowed it, and thus we find ourselves here today. He admits his own shortcomings, his excessive drive, his aversion to interruption, his impatience to be on with it. He found it difficult to correct them willingly, and unfortunately, his misunderstanding of how the graces and the cordialities of life could work for him rather than against him always eluded him. He left the graces up to my mother. The man simply never gave up. But I also want you to know that his interest in his children was really never subordinated to the interest of the students. On the contrary, in fact, there were times when he was simply a bit too interested. When we as children wished for a little less interference, but we always learned to work around it, and I was so happy when Gary brought out the humorous side of my father's personality. We worked around his interference often with humor. I never dated a boy that his transcripts didn't appear on the desk of my father. And it was in the same with Floyd, his employment file appeared on the desk of my father. Regarding faculty committees, the buck always stops with the president, so he better be in control. He just needed a little more psychology. But in the long run, it's what he did that matters, not necessarily how others would do it. But he did it. He did it in his own way. And while it may give others pause, it renders me very proud and really full of wonderment that he was able to achieve so much. We have sitting in the audience today one of his secretaries. They were the ones that often received the brunt of his full work schedule. She wrote a letter, and with her permission, I'm going to quote just a couple of things. Hermine, stand up so they can see who you are. She said, "You call him an autocrat? Perhaps he was. However, when challenged, an opposing view was presented in as thorough a manner as was his, he demurred to the majority with dignity. Some people call him unlovable. Not true. To those who got to know Ernest, he was very lovable. His sense of honesty, fair play, and sense of humor, again, endeared him to his friends. Someone called him a dictator, and he responded, the only way to measure a man is from the shoulders up. He was aware that it was a hate-love relationship he had with his faculty, but to the man, they respected him."
Thank you all to the speakers and those who participated, and for all of you coming here to be here. We've run out of time, so I would suggest that if you have any questions, you might catch the speakers in the next 5 or 10 minutes. Thank you very much.